For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
None of us are complete leaders. So if we are all incomplete leaders, what we need is a complete team of people. And the core design actually gives you that platform so that you identify all the people that need to be involved with different skill set, different perspectives.
Change management is not a skill set health practitioners are routinely taught in medical and nursing school. When a clinician on the ground sees a problem that is affecting patient outcomes, it can be hard to know how to go about changing the system for the good. Professor Sabe Sabesan is a senior medical oncologist at the Townsville Cancer Centre and is clinical dean at Townsville University Hospital. He and Associate Professor Lyndon Roberts from Monash Health have written a perspective for the MJA on leading change management. They have developed a framework for clinicians to help guide them through a successful negotiation process. Professor Sabesan is my special guest today. Is it common in health systems for the management to be non-clinical people?
Depends on the where the health systems are, whether it's metropolitan or regional or rural. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there's a mixed bag of where the clinicians are in terms of management. But I would say my observation is that there is a mixed bag, but certainly clinicians in management roles are not consistent across the board. The main question I actually have always, whether the managers have to be clinicians or non-clinicians, or whether it's actually the system of enabling the clinicians to lead change. And I know in systems where clinicians or ex-clinicians are managers, and then also I know management, the business guys, business people in management, and you actually see good management or good leadership from both ends, also bad leadership and bad management from both sides.
So what's the key to good management when there's a non-clinician and leading the group?
I think in my view, in terms of change management or leading clinicians, whether they are clinical managers or non-clinical people, really a system of engagement and involving all layers in change management rather than who should be leading. But as long as there's a system of involving clinicians as experts in clinical care and clinical systems, then I think we will avoid a lot of the tensions we have between managers and clinicians.
So we need a bit of collaboration, basically.
It is about collaborative leadership, collaborative approach, and also co-design or partnership models. One other thing I've been passionate about is that the health system is unlike business systems.
Right.
It is multidisciplinary, multi-layered. It's complex. So we really need a collaborative model. The command and control doesn't work.
Are clinicians usually the first ones to see that it's not working?
A lot of the health-related issues, the first people to actually observe and notice the problem or success or failure of any model of care or system change is actually the clinicians. Patients may feel it, but most of the time, clinicians will feel the tension because something has changed. Suddenly it's not working and it affects them, affects their morale, affects their flow, affects their efficiencies. So I think clinicians bear the brunt of any change.
If I'm a doctor and I see something that's not working and that's affecting patient outcomes, how easy is it for me to go and say, this needs to change?
Yeah, I think this is where the tension starts. When clinicians identify a problem on the ground that's causing tension, affecting morale and causing moral injury, then the next step for the clinicians is actually then take it up with someone or take it up through a system. And then it really depends on the culture of the organization, how that clinician is going to now navigate. And if the culture is good, partnership models, obviously clinicians can raise the issues and identify stakeholders and move it much easier. But if the culture is not good, I think most clinicians give up because the brick walls pop up very quickly. And clinicians actually don't know how to navigate those brick walls. And that's actually what led us to put together this article on art and science, because in the last 18 years, we had a lot of trial and error, knocking and many brick walls and suffering intracerebral hemorrhages. And so I thought really our clinicians need to acquire some skill set while advocating for system change.
So there's a problem. A clinician thinks it needs changing. What's the first thing they should do?
One of the things I find is when we raise problems, we actually need to take a systematic approach. You know, in the old saying, it says pick your battles and make sure the problem you raise is actually a problem. Sometimes what happens, we tend to be reactive as well as clinicians. So you might find something not working. It may be just not working because of my issue, because I may not know how to navigate the new computer system, but it might be working well for everyone else. Suddenly I raise it as an issue and causing all the tension. So this is where the implementation science framework actually is useful. And I don't think many of the clinicians actually don't know that there is a framework for implementation science. So what the implementation science does, it takes you to the first step. There's a problem. So is it actually a problem? Can you quantify the problem? And is it so important that you actually need to do something about it?
You need to ask yourself some questions before you take it to the next step.
Of course, because you're actually going to invest your time and expecting others to invest their time. So we got to make sure that what we are raising is actually legitimate. So we need data. We need to make sure it's a big enough problem. It's also affecting a lot of staff, not just me, but also make sure that the problem has impact on the system. So that's what I used to say, you know, who cares if the wall is painted yellow or white? You know, we have bigger problems to deal with. So make sure that the problem is worthwhile and you can articulate. And also we should be able to articulate why that problem needs to be fixed. So this is where I like the Simon Sinek's starting with the why philosophy. But the next step is actually make sure we got all the stakeholders' perspectives. I normally, what I do is if I see a problem, make sure I have talked to 10, 15 people to suss out whether they share the same concerns. And if I'm the only one raising the concern and everyone else is happy, I might have to drop that idea. That's why I'm saying, you know, there are data for problems we raise, you know, like, for example, safety data. You know, you could pull out Staph aureus infection rate, whereas certain things don't have any data. So we actually need to provide either anecdotal data or a qualitative information. And that only comes from talking to a number of people as a, almost like a mini qualitative study.
You talked earlier about a co-design approach. What does that actually look like in practice?
Co-design is a partnership model to leading change. So in that co-design, from the time you think about an idea, we need to involve people. So co-design is about people and the right people with multiple perspectives. Yes. So in health, you know, you have 10 people who are innovators, that is not going to be co-design, because we need to have safety and quality. We need to have legals. We need to have governance. We need to have multidisciplinary, so medical, nursing, allied health, admin teams. So co-design about bringing all the stakeholders to make sure what we are proposing and what we are designing is going to be impactful and is foolproof. That is all it is, really, co-design.
I'm chatting with Professor Sabe Sarbason from Townsville Cancer Centre. His co-authored article on clinician leadership in change management is available at mja.com.au. The link to the article is in the show notes for this podcast. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up with our earlier episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. To receive notifications of upcoming episodes, you can subscribe to our feed at Apple Music, Spotify, Audible, and Amazon Music. Just search for the Medical Journal of Australia and click the subscribe button. Back to our chat. Is it bringing in different skill sets?
The purpose of core design is to actually bring in different skill sets because, you know, in management circles, they always believe that none of us are complete leaders. So if we are all incomplete leaders, what we need is a complete team of people. And the core design actually gives you that platform so that you identify all the people that need to be involved with different skill set, different perspectives, so that what we have designed is actually good and implementable. But also the importance of the core design is actually that because you are involving people from the beginning at the stage of concept stage, so you are developing the implementation plan together and you are identifying enablers and barriers together. And then these are the people who are going to implement as well. So actually the implementation itself has begun at the time of co-designing. So that is a slick and a much more pleasant way of implementing change rather than four or five people sit together, have a document written, and then go and try to say, okay, now we are going to implement. Suddenly you're getting pushbacks from everyone.
You talk in your article about the levers that clinicians can bring to bear on getting change happening. What is a clinician lever?
So the clinician levers idea really came when we were learning about managers and CEOs and people in authority. So they have a lot of levers purely because of their positions. Authority, yeah, they have a management lever. So then we realize everyone needs their levers. So what happened for clinicians then, whether they are middle management or on the floor, they actually don't have access to the authority levers. So then we were thinking, okay, what will give you the ability to sit and negotiate? So the clinician levers are about strategies and arguments you can make simply because you're a clinician. That will then keep the partners engaged in a negotiation. Otherwise, what happened, there's a power imbalance and the person in a powerful position will always win the negotiation and they can walk away. For clinicians, we can't walk away because if you walk away, you lose your goal. The clinician levers idea actually give us a framework to use these strategies that really work on the goodwill of other people. So we identified four sets of levers. People always respond to something to do with patient safety and quality. So we can always think about, why are we doing this? Because there is a patient harm, there is a benefit for patients, there's a patient travel involved, patient's quality of life. So then we thought patient-related levers, and also at a higher level, we have patient peak bodies. You know, patient advocacy groups, community groups. So connection with them is one set of levers. And then the second one we thought workforce well-being, doctor well-being, nurse well-being, morale, workforce productivity. It's a big thing, but we don't really take advantage of that. So then we thought, okay, actually, why is it important? Because it affects the staff morale and it affects their well-being. So then we thought, workforce related levers. And then at a higher level, all our, you know, union, industrial bodies, clinical peak bodies, you have access to. And then the third one is, why are we doing it? Because there are standards, accreditation standards, there is enterprise bargaining standards, there are national, international guidelines. So we can actually always say what's happening here is actually breaching these standards. So we need to make sure that by fixing it, we'll adhere to these standards. So these first three are really about working with people's goodwill, and most people in health have goodwill. So it actually does work. But we need to think about them upfront and use them every time we are facing frustration or roadblocks. We need to keep saying all these things, and then other people come on the journey. But sometimes what happened, despite having all those three levers, people still don't listen, maybe because they have a different priority, or maybe they don't care. So then this is where the escalation comes in. So escalation, we have access to escalation in day-to-day practice. You know, we have line managers, we have divisional managers, CEOs, And then depending on which level you are in, you know, you go to the boards, media, politicians, so endless number of levers. But the only thing I caution about the escalation is normally escalation means there will be a damage to a relationship. So you're actually now escalating. But my approach to escalation is I normally, part of my respectful negotiation, using the first three levers, I then, you know, be upfront, you know, looks like what we are doing is not working. So are you happy for me to escalate now? That is really informing that person that I'm actually going to use my lever, that is my right as an employee of an organization to escalate. And also sometimes I actually think, sometimes I look at people and say, which is important? Is my goal and my belief in the system and the patient welfare, staff welfare, is that actually more important than a coffee relationship with someone? Then I might have to sacrifice some of the relationship. And that's life, but that's where the courageous leaderships come in.
I guess there's a risk to your career as well.
I think escalations can be problematic in cultures that are not good. In a good culture, escalation should be normal because that is why we have line management. But unfortunately, in all layers and across the systems, I think people need to be careful about their careers because that can destroy their careers. So before escalation, I would say think about two things. One is the importance of a relationship and then the impact on your career. And I'm pretty sure that shouldn't be a barrier for us to lead change because we have to make a difference to these people.
The last section of your paper is about self-care. What do you mean by that and why is it important in this context?
Self-care is important in health practice anyway, because, you know, health practice is very complex. You know, we learned during COVID as well, quite stressful, a lot of demands, workloads, and people get sick and we go to cover. So self-care is important in day-to-day practice, even at our normal lives. You know, we've got to be caring about ourselves. But what I found when we lead change, sometimes it takes a lot of your time. It can take years, and sometimes it consumes your weekends. So I actually learned over time that when we are taking on a challenge or leading change, we got to make sure that the boundaries are set carefully, the work-life balance is set carefully, we invest in our families, and also make sure we invest in ourselves with exercise, sleep, rest, and make sure when we go out, we don't talk about, you know, my project. But I think also the part of the self-care also involves understanding the partners you are dealing with, not just family partners, it's actually in the workplace. If I am negotiating with someone, make sure that I understand the other person's perspective because they might be under different pressures. They might be on a short-term contract, whereas I'm on a permanent contract. So I think respect, kindness, and that humanity still need to be considered before we call names about people when things are not going well. So that's actually part of self-care, so that we also look after the people who we are trying to change. So, so I think the whole thing about finding and working with levers is also an important aspect of self-care, because when you feel confident that you have your levers, you're less likely to be frustrated and emotionally drained.
Do you find that this framework for change management works whether the culture is good or bad?
In terms of frameworks for change, I find you rather follow a good framework than not. Because if you don't follow the framework, you fail from the beginning. So if you have a framework, you are more likely to be successful. But in a good culture, it's going to be so easy because everyone is going to come on board. But even in a culture that is not fantastic, I think if you follow this framework and apply the levers judiciously and cautiously, you will still change and see the outcome. And hopefully by all the clinicians acquiring these frameworks, you create a critical mass of leaders now who are skilled enough to lead change rather than giving up too early. Yep. But I also feel that even managers who actually need to use these clinicians' levers mm-hmm. when they need to change the clinicians.
Yes, so it works both ways.
It works both ways. So I think even good managers should be able to use their clinician levers, not just relying on their autocratic levers. So they are more likely to succeed using clinicians' levers when they become partners. And lastly, I think these kind of frameworks and topics, I wish that we had been taught in our med school so that it become part of our psyche. What we need is actually a skill set, not leadership, not as a philosophy,
yep.
Leading change as a skill set.
Thank you, Sabe. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.